check your worldview at the door. So let go of how you think the world is. Embrace how other people see the world, and embrace being kind of the key verb. Like, we really want to just lean in and grab everything we can about how other people make sense of the world. The third is build rapport. Rapport is what makes the conversation in an interview like feel good to both parties. And the fourth is listen. And, you know, creating spaces for somebody to talk where we're present with them and for them, but we're not putting ourselves in it. We're not giving them, it's that empathy versus sympathy thing.
Hi, I'm Mike Green, and welcome to Understanding Users, the podcast where I chat candidly with UX design and research professionals from around the world to hear about how they build digital products and services in a user-centered way. So I'm delighted to be talking this time to Steve Portugal. And Steve is a very experienced user researcher, well-known name in the user research space that many listeners will be familiar with. He helps organizations build kind of more mature user research practices. He's based out of the US, and he's the author of two books, Doorbell's Danger and Dead Batteries, and also Interviewing Users, which a new edition of has just come out. And I'd like to talk to him today in a bit more detail about that. And he's also the host of the Dollars to Donuts podcast, which I'm always keen to chat to fellow podcast hosts. So it's so lovely to have you on the show, Steve, and welcome.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about, so Interviewing Users, the original version, I think came out about 10 years ago. Is that right?
That's right.
For those who kind of haven't read the book, what were the kind of key principles and concepts that you wanted to share?
And that book was sort of, you know, me spending years, you know, writing about research, teaching, doing workshops, doing research, of course, myself. And, you know, so it's kind of a process in writing that book of, I think back 11 or 12 years ago, that whole journey was like, yeah, how do you kind of wrap that up? And like, that was my first book. So what is a book, and how does all the things that you know and do and tell other people to do, how do you kind of put that in this other form, which, you know, most of us have read books, but a few of us have written them. So there was definitely this whole sort of sorting out piece to like, what is, to your question, like, what did I want to help people learn? It was just a lot of, it was not an easy question to answer, because I didn't sort of know how do you go from one form to a non sort of linear version of that form. But I think some of the things that have stuck, you know, it's like a whole book, so there's lots of stuff. But, you know, I think there was a framework that I articulated there that, you know, there's lots and lots of tips and tricks and best practices and, you know, how to do this and how to do that. And you know, I continue to work on those and collect those because I think they're so helpful for us in our practice. But I wanted to enlarge sort of the thinking a little bit around, I'm going to call it a framework, but I know, you know, somebody may say, well, that's not a framework, but a set of principles are sort of, you know, what are sort of four things to good research, you know, and research and interviews in particular. And so those four things are, check your worldview at the door. So let go of how you think the world is. Embrace how other people see the world, and embrace being kind of the key verb. Like, we really want to just lean in and grab everything we can about how other people make sense of the world. The third is build rapport. Rapport is what makes the conversation in an interview like feel good to both parties. And the fourth is listen. And you know, so a lot of the book is just kind of unpacking those things or making sense of them or giving some like best practices and some tips around that. You know, so if someone was going to not read that first book, and wanted to know like, what's a couple of things, I would say like, well, start with that. That's going to take you really, really far. There's a whole book in there about other stuff, but that at least is kind of a, you know, is an orientation to kind of where the thinking starts, I guess.
Fantastic. And having done scores of user interviews myself over the years, that absolutely resonates. It's lovely to hear it, you know, boiled down into such a sort of succinct framework that I think we can all identify with. Tell me, you know, 10 years, I mean, in these days in our world, a month feels like a long time. You know, a year can feel like a lifetime in terms of the speed of change, particularly with, you know, the growth of AI, which I'm sure we'll come on to. And I don't want to labor the point too much because there's so much chat of AI at the moment. But kind of in general, over the last 10 years, Steve, kind of how has the field of UX research evolved, do you think? And, you know, what are the key trends and changes that you've seen which inspired you to write a second edition of the book?
I mean, I will say I denied having any interest in writing a second edition for a long time, with the kind of the disclaimer, like, well, what's changed? Like, that framework that I just described, like, well, that's evergreen. Like, that's, these are people, this is listening. You know, in some ways, like, I wanted to celebrate the 10th anniversary because I thought, and your question kind of gets at this, like, that's a long period of time. And my own career is different. The field is different. And so I started off kind of refuting it, like, well, nothing's changed. Why would I ever update this book? You know, and then you accumulate these things that you're kind of embarrassed by. Like, in the first edition, there's a really strong exhortation to, like, give people cash immediately at the end of a part of participating in research. And wow, our relationship to money has changed, you know, over the last 3 years for sure, but I think gradually along that period of time. So that's maybe like the thin edge of the wedge, like, you know, to force me to see that the world changes around us, even though we sort of hold tight to what we believe. So, you know, interviewing people is interviewing people, but the context in which we do that, like, the world of work has changed, the world of, you know, design, user experience, tech, because most of the people that read this are in tech, not all, but so that has changed. And so realizing the world has changed, even though the book is the same, and yet it's got to acknowledge a different world. So if you go back a certain amount of time, like, user research was not in its origin necessarily, like, in its early origins where I started, it was not an in-house activity. It was an agency and consultancy activity. And that's where I started. That's kind of how I grew up. That's still where I am. And I think there's an imagined audience and context for doing research that I think is more clearly worked out here in the second edition. So there's, like, who's doing research and where and kind of what context that I guess also continues to evolve. Sorry, there's a few different sort of shifts that are going on. So it used to be agencies. It eventually did become more of an in-house function. We didn't have research leadership inside organizations. So who was driving the change that's needed to have research go well? Who are those advocates? So there is actually a whole class of person, a profession that is a leader of research that, if you go back, we didn't have those kinds of things. Organizations didn't have formal operations processes for research. Some of that is around compliance. Some of that is around, you know, enabling and empowering the organization to actually do research well. So these things are all kind of changing. And then I know that this is sort of a big buzzword, this word democratization. I mean, that just means who does research, right? And I think you've always had the case where lots of people were doing research under different labels, at different quality, in different sort of silos or pockets of any organization. Now we've got a way to kind of refer to that. So, you know, if I look at the communities I speak with, like, you know, the product management profession started to really take notice of research a number of years ago and be really excited about getting better at it. You know, and how do you sort of build processes? How do you institutionalize it? Separate from whether they have access to UX or user research and so on. So the kind of the who and the where they are in the organization has kind of shifted, and are they in the organization or out, and what sort of support or infrastructure from an organizational point of view, whether that's processes, leadership, management, advocacy, that's all changed. So, you know, you can ask all the good follow-up questions you want, but the way that the work of doing that is going to be effective in getting us to the outcomes we want, like better products and services experiences for different customers or new opportunities that the company can harness, all that stuff that we're driving towards, like that context has really evolved dramatically over 10 years and more. But for sure, you know, between additions, the context has changed. And I hope, I mean, it certainly was my intention that, you know, that I'm speaking to that new context in a more deliberate way.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned there the world of work and how it's changed. And the one thing that we haven't touched on so far is obviously the pandemic and you know, the COVID years, if I can call them that. I'm interested to get your sense of how that impacted user research as a discipline. Because speaking for myself, obviously the work has continued and it's continued at pace, but I can't remember the last time I sat in somebody's office or you know, place of work or even their home and actually interviewed them face to face, which, you know, some ways you can, it speeds up research. You can get more done remotely. There's, you know, people are perhaps more relaxed if they're sitting in their own homes on Zoom. But there's a loss, I think. Personally, as a researcher, I find a not being in the context of the individuals surrounded by what's on their walls and what's around them and the kind of movement of their, you know, environment. It's harder in some ways to get the insights, but I'm interested to know kind of what's your perspective on how the pandemic changed, for good or ill, kind of what we do.
I mean, 100% to everything that you just said about loss. I mean, that's the word that I use. I mean, I don't know that it's a permanent. I think the world of work is continuing to change. You know, as we're sitting here on this day, you know, it's the beginning of the year where we're talking. I haven't seen 800 RTO articles, return to office articles, but it seems like, you know, there's a constant discussion about that. And it's interesting because, like, for sure the pandemic changed work, but it also triggered lots of, I don't know, bigger and more uncomfortable sort of discussions about power, like bosses and property owners that, you know, have a stake in how work takes place and where it takes place. And, you know, worker power kind of pushing back on that. And, you know, depending on where you live and what industry you're in, you're going to see that more or less. So like, I'm just saying that remote research is being affected by these much larger shifts that I don't have any sort of brilliance on, but I think that we're continuing to be in the middle of. So, right. Absolutely. I have not sat with someone in their place of doing whatever it is that they're doing and interviewed them. And I just said at the beginning of our conversation, embrace how other people see the world. Well, that's the way to do it, right? You go, you let go of your thing and go to their thing. And it is harder. And it's harder for me, they're clients, but for other people, it's their colleagues. It's harder for us as researchers to facilitate that, oh, kind of reaction that we're going for, right? We want people to know that their assumptions are wrong. And you can get these really, like, you know, jaw on the floor moments that we work to facilitate. We work to create those, you know, uncover those narratives and have our teammates let go of their biases and their assumptions and their aspirations. And that's hard to do without taking people out. It was not only what we got to do, which meant that we could connect with people. We could see stuff that we didn't know we wanted to ask about. We could be uncomfortable. We could be forced as researchers. And then we could create, I think, effective experiences for other people to also, you know, make the work transformative. And that's a big fancy word, but that, right, we're all changed by doing this. I really miss doing that. You know, I have peers that are like, oh, someone today was talking about some overseas trip they were doing to do field work. Like, I don't even have to go to some exotic environment, like different than my own. I just would like to sit in an office or, you know, walk around a firehouse or something like that. So I think these things are going to continue to change. But I think there's two fronts is what I'm trying to say here, right? What do we experience in the field, but also what do we experience with our, you know, collaboration and facilitation of the people we work with? And I think this also happens after the field work. If everything that we do takes place in a remote workspace and not, you know, more often is asynchronously, we're also having fewer of those. I mean, I can think of just times where I've had like clients and colleagues and we're offsite, we're spending several days, in a room for a couple of days going through this stuff and trying to make sense of it. And just having like life-changing insights come up. And that is so grandiose, my language. I mean, when someone comes up with something that riffs off of something that someone else says, and you can just sort of like, you know, just feel a bunch of ideas come into alignment. Like it's a really powerful intellectual creative moment. And I haven't had that for a while since I've been working where my participants are in a Zoom room and my, you know, colleagues are, you know, before and after the research. And so I don't know, personally, I've struggled with the work feeling a little more transactional. And I think that is sort of coincident with like other pressures on the work of research. So I don't know, I'm throwing everything into like a big, hairy, ugly ball of smush stuff together. And I think when you bring up like remote and pandemic, it like, oh yeah, there's all these things that are kind of connected to that. And I don't know how to kind of tease them apart in a sensible way. I think I'm being buffeted by those forces, I guess the way everybody else is, but yeah, I miss it. I think that's my bottom line is exactly what you said. Like there's a loss there and I hope we can, you know, evolve to a point where it is a necessary part of what the researchers do, what the team does, and to kind of have those experiences, which are so, inspirational.
Yeah, absolutely. And following on from that, another thing I wanted to pick up with you is the issue of kind of tooling. And I suppose it's driven by the movement to more remote research is, you know, cast our minds back 5-10 years, the sort of tools that a researcher had at their disposal were fairly limited. You know, you could sort of take your laptop out. You could maybe use a QuickTime player to record somebody. You might have a kind of handheld microphone. And I know one of your earlier book kind of dealt with a lot of those issues and the kind of tooling that users have. But these days, there's a plethora of platforms, knowledge repositories, recording tools, analysis tools. AI is built into some of this stuff. So there's automatic kind of transcription done. Again, I'm interested to hear kind of from you, what's your view on how that's changing user research, and how that's making the life of the UR easier or perhaps in some ways more complicated.
Yeah. I worked at an organization where there was a very small research ops practice. And, this guy, I'll just call him this guy. He was just really good at, stitching the different pieces together. But he was also very, you know, he's like a lot of people that sort of do, I'm not saying he was a tech support person, but he had that quality that some tech support people have, which is not to jump off and do something, but to really push you to articulate why is this going to change something and to kind of prioritize that. And so I think that meant in the best case, there was not a zillion different ways to do a zillion different things. But you saw how hard it was to make stuff work together. I think there are so many tools and they do certain pieces and they make certain assumptions about how people work. So think of, you talk about repository. I think that's a great one. Right. What do we do with the stuff from research afterwards? Because people want to know, do we know anything about X or what happened to this kind of thing? And I think there is a very shallow sort of, I guess with any sort of tool, there can be a shallow view of the problem and then a poor fit solution. you know, and I think things, you know, someone like this guy that I'm mentioning would, you know, he would want to see a conversation about, and I'm now extrapolating from my experience with him, but, you know, when you think about a repository, for example, like what kind of stuff do you want to put in that repository? Is it every recording? Is it, you know, notes? Is it decks? Is it recommendations? So what goes in? Who puts it in? Who maintains it? Because, right, sometimes it's a SharePoint drive where no one can find anything. Who will be retrieving things? Is it a researcher who's like, oh, I want to go get this raw data so I can reanalyze it? Or is it a, quote, stakeholder who wants to know, hey, do we know anything about how people do X? So I think there's a, I don't think organizations, or I don't think anyone's figured out this is the way to have that work. So, like, I think the problem is not universal. The problem is very custom and kind of unthought through. And so, you know, how do you make a solution for that? You know, and I think this is, it's great that there are operations people and there are leaders whose job it is to think about how do they work with their peers and other functions and to gatekeep some of that. Now, we're not going to make raw data available because that's not, we don't want people synthesizing that or whatever. We have a data retention policy, and so we're going to do it this way. So I guess when I hear these sort of, these categories of tools thrown around, to me, they stand in as, I don't know, proxies for more complicated issues around how we're all going to work and what we're all going to do and what we kind of expect. It's kind of the maturity, not only of the research practice, but of, you know, the product practice, like how are we making decisions? How are our beliefs informed and how do they evolve and kind of who owns decisions and all this kind of, you know, more elusive cultural stuff about the practice seems tied into like what kind of tool you have. I'll stop there.
You raise lots of really interesting points. And you know, one of the things that you kind of started to touch on was this issue of, you know, data retention, data privacy. So as you say, letting, who do you give access to all this stuff? I mean, a recent client I work with, they'd adopted one of the large sort of, you know, industry leading repositories. I won't name it. Doesn't really matter. But, you know, rather than sort of trialing two or three of them side by side, there was this, because of the complexity of the procurement process within said organization, it was like, we can just about sell this into the organization, right? We're going to buy this. And actually it transpired that over a period of time, given that they were very digitally mature, it wasn't really fit for purpose. But by then, you know, budgets had been signed off and this thing had been bought and so on. And it was kind of like, you know, yeah, I suppose on the flip side, the good thing is perhaps it's a positive in the sense of, you know, the value of user research is now established, which has led to the development of these tools. You know, in the early days when UR was still this slightly strange underground thing, there wouldn't have been the justification to build tooling like this. So I guess it's as you say, it's kind of how you use it and who uses it. And as long as the organization is clear what the need is and why they're adopting whatever they're adopting. let's talk about research ops, because you've touched on that a few times, and I know in the new edition of the book you've got a, you know, you kind of focus on that a bit more. There was a nice little essay, a short kind of piece from Kate Tozzi talking about, you know, research ops in the book. Tell me more about that and kind of why you wanted to focus a bit more on research ops.
I mean, it's we were talking before about sort of roles that, you know, didn't exist and who did research and what was the infrastructure. You know, research ops sort of emerged as a term, as a community, as a practice. You know, they I'm going to other them. They have their own conferences and their own, you know, communities. I mean, that's all something that's really new. It's a career path for people. It's really new, I think, you know, relatively speaking, across those 10 years. You know, I think, you know, the logistics discussion, I think, was quite, I don't know, loosey-goosey, to use an old person's kind of term. Like, I think it was not sort of well, like, my advice for years was, oh, if you're going to talk to a participant, like, getting a release is a good idea. And, I think it was Kate actually who looked at some things that I had written, and her, I just got a text comment from her, but you could almost imagine her eyebrows going up like, a good idea, right? It's a requirement. It's a compliance requirement now. And I think there was a period of time where, like, I mean, legally and ethically, they were requirements. But I think as someone who was giving advice to companies, I didn't feel like I would be heard if I said, you must do this. I think there was still, like, you know, reasons why research wasn't going to happen if there had to be certain amounts of to get a user to sign a document that implied some relationship around the data between the company and that person, you know, has to go through legal, and legal was a blocker, and now ideally legal is a, you know, is a department that is an enabler, is a partner. So I think, you know, ops and legal are not the same thing, but you can see sort of a changing belief in what research is, and then how do we set it up so that it's successful, at least according to some categories of successful. It's not providing, you know, there's financial traceability, and there is, like, you know, compliance and stuff that will pass an audit. You know, and I don't know, I think in the olden times that might have seemed like a barrier, but I really liked what Kate had to say, and she corrected me quite kindly that I was sort of putting a lot of the logistics under operations, and her reframe was that operations is about, you know, helping an organization be positioned to do research in an effective way, as opposed to executing on those logistics tasks. So I think, you know, in the book now I talk about operations and kind of its goal, but also those logistics things. And again, thanks to the work of operations people, we can have a more mature and elevated discussion about those logistics. So that, I think, is the work of ops, right? They're getting the field ready, the practice, the organization ready to, you know, build repeatable processes, have templates, have compliance things, have, you know, ways that things can work. So that research can be done well, as opposed to kind of doing it for us. I think that was maybe the, you know, if you go back in time a little bit, you know, teams would hire their own participant recruiter. That was a big change. Yeah. That there was someone on the team, and all they did was sort of admin facilitation kind of work. And, you know, my mistaken model was to think that that's what a research ops department would do. And Kate, again, was really great. She's like, no, it's not. We're not doing that work. We're setting up the processes. We're setting up, whether that's procurement or hiring or job description or databases or whatever that is, that's going to make recruiting participants something that's effective and repeatable and efficient and, you know, digs into what the real needs are of that organization.
All of that presupposes a certain size of organization, a kind of profile of organization, because to have the resources and ability to kind of set up that kind of facility, basically you need to be a pretty big organization, I would assume. You can't do that. I mean, a research ops department, I guess, you know, it's the more mature, digitally mature organizations which would typically have that. Is that fair to say, or am I wrong?
I think that's true, but I think it scales down. You know, if, right, ops is a department, is ops, maybe ops is an activity or ops is an objective. You know, I worked for this very early, at least in terms of their design maturity and their research maturity, they had no staff researchers. They had like a design leader who was trying to kind of build this up. And, you know, I just started to see that, like, the way that we were getting participants was an engineer would go to some CRM that was handling all their marketing and email campaigns and so on. But there was some back end on that. I don't remember what it was called. So tools, not for research, not even for marketing. They were like, you had to get an engineer to write a query to pull something out, that then we would send them some form in some other format. And it was just, it was like a, after kind of going through this a couple of times, it seemed like this was a lot of work and it wasn't repeatable. And once people in the organization found out there was someone doing some research like myself, I was getting all these questions about finding participants, asking questions. So there was a lot of reinventing the wheel. And so I'm not, you know, I don't have an ops, a head for ops necessarily, but I could see what some of these repeatable pieces were. And I just started making a list of what they were. I was able to kick that over to somebody else who brought someone from, I don't know, some other ops part of the organization over, and they were kind of given this list to just start, you know, let's say it's the email you send to people from the company to say, hey, would you fill out this form and be willing to be in a study? Like, there's no reason to write that over and over and over again. So for someone to write one or to curate what they all are and make it kind of available. So I think that is, you know, I'm not talking about world changing stuff, but I think that's like very, very small scale, you know, improving the ability of the organization to do research just by, you know, capturing best practice, little bits and pieces and making them available and sort of surfacing them to the rest of the organization. I think that's like a low investment, high reward kind of activity that starts to point to, again, I'm not the ops person, so apologies to anybody who thinks I'm getting this wrong, but it starts to point to like, what's the progression towards that sort of digital mature organization you're talking about. Everything's humming. They've got a lot of needs and they've got people kind of building on that, but I think you could start very small and make a real impact.
One thing that's always bothered me, continues to bother me, one of the challenges of us as a discipline, as user researchers, is, you know, with the best will in the world, you can have the best method, you can have the best, you know, you could be the best interviewer, you could have the best is the wrong word, but you could talk to suitable participants, you can gather all this insight, but you could crash headlong into a brick wall where you meet an organization which is, for whatever reason, disconnected, digitally immature, doesn't want to hear the research, is convinced it knows the answers already. And we've all encountered this, I'm sure. And I know you cover some of this in the book, but I'm interested to get your reflections on that and tips and tricks, particularly for early career researchers, because it's extremely, it can be extremely disheartening, can't it, to run up against that. And unless you've got buy-in from kind of more senior individuals, how to go about changing that and selling the value of what we do effectively.
Yeah, selling the value of what we do is interesting because, well, all of this takes place at different points in time. And I often think about, insomnia, that's sort of a reflection of my sleeping, but I often think of insomnia as kind of an analogy. You know, when you wake up at 2 a.m. or whatever time you wake up and you can't sleep and your brain is doing stuff. Unfortunately, that's not the time to intervene into creating a solution so that you sleep better. Right? Everything is like, oh, exercise in the morning, not after dinner. Don't eat spicy foods after 7 p.m. Some people, you know, don't want any blue lights or whatever it is after a certain time of day. You know, don't nap. All those things don't take place at 2 a.m. But that is that time you run into that wall. And so I think, you know, if you're an early career researcher, I think I would encourage you to think about that the kinds of choices you make or the interventions you do or the way that you structure the research to sell the value of it happens at so many different points. I'd say like happens at all the points. And so one way that there's one flavor of the brick wall that is quite common. It's the we already knew that factor. Yeah. Totally. So, right, you go through this work and you deliver something and you – like, it's important. Like, people better understand this. Our product's going to fail, or here's an opportunity to do really, really well. And someone says, like, oh, yeah, we already knew that. And, you know, there are things that you can do then, yes, but there are things that you can do ahead of time to kind of preempt that. So one thing is at the beginning of the project, for example, like, talking to people about why do you want to do this research? What problem are we trying to solve? What do we already know? You know, what do you expect to hear? You know, what are things that you are going to work on as a result of this? To ask those questions so that as a researcher, we're representing kind of a, I don't know, someone could draw a good Venn diagram from this. Like, what do we think collectively as an organization, and what's the world and the belief structure of the people we want to build for? And so to come in, you know, we bring the outside world back into the company, right? If we bring in that, what our customers and users think, without the context of what do we think, like just from a persuasion point of view, it's much harder to do that. Guess what? People like chocolate. Like, I mean, so I think sometimes we already knew that is a valid response, because the researchers coming in very excited about what they've discovered, and they either don't know or they don't acknowledge the initial context. Right? You want to come in and say, right, our sales figures for chocolate have been consistently good and our Yelp reviews are really strong. You know, we all talk here about how much people love chocolate. It's interesting, in the research we heard that people love chocolate not just for its taste, but for its emotional resonance. I don't know, now I'm making stuff up, but right, to be able to say we knew X and we learned Y, or sometimes it is we thought X was true, but what is true is, like, you know, X prime, just to be nerdy about it. Like, we thought people loved chocolate, but what people love is giving chocolate. And so to be able to say, you know, what's the delta between what we assumed and what we discovered, is a way to help people, you know, that we want to inform, we want to influence, to help them move from what their current belief structure is, first of all, by acknowledging, and it's compassionate to acknowledge it, and then to give them the scaffolding to move from that to the new thing that the research said. If we can involve them in planning the research, choosing who to talk to, because there's nothing worse than kind of coming to a presentation, having someone in that presentation say, like, oh, did you talk to people that, you know, blah, 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 grew up in carob eating countries? It's like, no, we didn't. Oh, well, this research is not valid, because that's my mental model. So you want to have those conversations where you can early on. You want to have them come with you into the field, whatever that looks like technically, so they can hear some of those stories. They don't have to make sense of them or, you know, understand what the conclusions are. But when you say, you know, the gift-giving occasion around chocolate is really kind of significant, that person's, you know, your stakeholder's going to go, oh yeah, we heard that person cry because they were happy as they were recalling the Valentine's gift they got from their fiance. Like, yeah, it's better that you remember something that you experienced than me tell you. We had one participant cry. Like, it's so much better if they remember it, and that we have kind of, you know, experiences that kind of carry it forward. So, you know, creating as many of those moments to go on that journey together, because it is a bunch of activities, but it's about sorting out how we feel about things and how we understand things and how we connect disparate pieces of quote data about people together. So trying to set that up in a way. And, you know, I think a response to me saying this is like, that's all well and good, Steve, but no one will give me any time, right? Yeah. I can't get on anybody's calendar. We're very busy. No, we don't believe in meetings. People just want the answers. You know, I think that's, you kind of talking before about, you know, kind of the, is you are some mysterious thing, or is it like understood and kind of embraced? And you can only go so far by throwing something over the wall. You're going to get that we already knew that, or the, yeah, I don't care, or the so what, if you can't sort of practice it as a creative, collaborative, I know journey is an overused word, but it is, it's a shared process.
I was just about to say exactly the same thing. It's that, you know, co-creation again is a bit of another cliche, but like bringing people with you on the journey. I always try and get even senior stakeholders to come in as observers on some of the kind of interviews that I do online and so on, just to, you know, again, it's very difficult because everyone's so busy, but even one, you know, one person joining one session, if there's some good insight there, you can almost see the light bulbs going on as they're listening. And it's, as you say, it can be very powerful. If there was one thing, Steve, that you wanted readers of the book to take away with them, having read it, what would it be?
You know, I think there's this a tip that I'll offer, kind of a, you know, that I think is counterintuitive. And this is about how much we bring ourselves into the interview. I think there's a very well-intentioned, if naive, thing that I see researchers do, or people who do research who maybe haven't, you know, thought about this as much, is, you know, try to build that rapport, that essential rapport with participants, by showing their participants that, hey, I'm just like you. I share in this issue or this concern. So when someone is being interviewed and they say, oh, I just couldn't get that thing to install, and I had to go into the Apple store and go to the Genius Bar, and they like had to fix something, and it was just really a pain. You know, the naive researcher may, with all the best intentions, say, oh my God, that happened to me too. It is such a pain. It's so hard. You know, it can happen around trivial things like people expressing preferences. I love chocolate with caramel in it. I love chocolate with cherries in it. Oh my God, me too. And I think that's kind of how we're trained socially, right? The world trains us to sort of be likable and be liked by finding common ground with somebody. That's what we're kind of told always to do. There is actually research on this, besides, I think, just, you know, experience, that says that asking them about themselves is actually a way to create that connection. Like, people are more liked if you ask questions about them. So when someone says, I love chocolate with cherries in it, you may think to yourself that you love that, but you actually do not have to say that. Mm-hmm. So I think just because you feel that impulse and you can get excited and you want to be with this person, I think it takes some discipline to hold on, to feel that enthusiasm and to hold on to it and to keep the focus on them, and to say, like, what is it about that you like? What, you know, where do you buy them? How often do you get that? Like, what other flavors do you like? To keep the focus on them. The interview is about them. You know, some professions, right? Like, I mean, I think, you know, the television therapist, forget what actual therapy is like, but the television therapist, right, is really good at like keeping it not about them. And there's ethical reasons for that, but there's also efficacy reasons to do that. It's not a chit chat. Even though we're using the tools of conversation to do that, you know, you and I are using the tools of conversation, but we're making an episode of something.
Yeah.
And so we find ourselves in places where we're using what feels conversational, but we have to kind of override some of those impulses. And I think there's a discipline that can be uncomfortable to like making it about them. And I'll just say the corollary or the caveat to that is there are times when you bring yourself into it. And the most effective ones to me are when that person is stuck. That person feels uncomfortable. They feel like they're at risk of being judged. They're not sure if they're on kind of safe territory. You know, I interviewed someone very early in my career, early on mentioned being Jewish. And, you know, I, Steve Portigal, am Jewish. And it's like, I don't know, I'm Jewish and I'm Canadian. And so the two things that we do are hear people say those things and then say, me too, like that's just part of you know, being, you know, at least as a Canadian in the US, when you're not in the majority, you often want to, you know, identify with those things. So I had to really hold back when this person said that she was Jewish, because there's just a built-in response. And so it wasn't until later in the interview when she was describing something about holidays and something about how that drove her decision about whatever it was we were talking about. It was a long time ago. And she just stopped and kind of like checked in with us, like looked back and forth at the two people conducting the interview. And that's when I said, so then we're now like 40 minutes after the first time it came up. That's when I said, yes, I'm Jewish. And so that was serving to build the rapport. If I'd brought it up at the beginning, I was talking about myself, but here I'm revealing something about myself in service of that connection, in service of that discussion. And because I felt like in the moment, this would help her in this interview. You know, and we didn't compare notes afterwards. It was very much tied to the thing she was trying to tell us and she was stuck on. So that's very different than like, oh my God, I'm Jewish too. Like, you know, what thing do you do or what do you have or whatever. It was really tactical at that point.
What about the rapport thing though, Steve? I totally agree with everything you're saying, but I guess it's that fine line you've got to tread between not over-empathizing, if I can put it like that, but at the same time building a rapport and ensuring that your participant is comfortable. And I guess that comes through practice. It's getting rapport quickly because you've got a finite amount of time with this individual. If they've never done something like this before, or for example, if they're a vulnerable group, and we've all, I'm sure, interviewed kind of vulnerable participants, you have to almost work extra hard and extra fast to get them at their ease, because otherwise you can't get the insights that you want. So it's an interesting balance, isn't it? And I guess, yeah, for me, it practice, you know, having done this for quite a few years now, it comes through that. And I still don't always get it right.
Yeah. And I think your follow-up is good because you're kind of, you're connecting the talk about yourself tip to this larger dynamic. And, you know, I think it shows up when someone says something, what response do you give? So I think there is, I think you can overcompensate for the objective that you're articulating and be like, yeah, yeah, cool. Okay. Got it. Like there's this verbal reassurance that's trying to tell this person who's giving you the cues that they're uncomfortable because they are, because they don't know what the heck's happening. Because what is this? Yeah. I think when we are uncomfortable, we overcompensate with a lot of demonstrative stuff, nodding, you know, bulging eyes, you know, just the speed and pace of the gestures is meant to kind of really over deliver. And I think remote makes that much harder. Like I pay attention to myself on remote and I am way more demonstrative over remote because it just feels remote.
Yes.
And I think that the tip is to kind of like pay attention to sort of what's your natural amount of that and just play with like turning the dial down. Like I think you can keep dialing it down. And so, you know, and people can't see us, right? But as you and I are looking at each other, you know, you're nodding a little bit. And I think there's a violent nod, a quick violent nod with a yeah, 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 yeah. And then there's like a single nod. And then there's just like cocking the chin. And then there's just like raising the eyebrows. It's like the difference between which is says yes, which actually has judgment in it. Because what we're trying to say to somebody is like, I heard you. But our tools for saying I heard you are to say I agree or I support, as opposed to just I heard you. So the difference between just like grunting at somebody. And I think I'm not a linguist, but I think like the Japanese have all this interesting stuff where they, there's just all this whole feedback loop. When you watch, you know, Japanese folks on the phone, they like give each other like, I'm hearing you signals, which are not any, they're not agreements or anything like that. There's just some stuff built in that kind of keeps the cycle going, you know, the send and receive cycle. And so I think, you know, if you are Japanese, then you have that in your toolkit culturally, maybe, or linguistically. But for those of us, you know, let's say Western English speakers, you know, our defaults are kind of not necessarily serving us as well. So what's the least amount that we can get away with? And I think that desire to be liked pushes us in the wrong direction. There's a feeling that if I just, you know, maintain eye contact while the person is talking, that I'm being cold, that I'm not having empathy, that I'm not, they're sharing something vulnerable. You know, you brought up that example, but I think, you know, oh, I'm so sorry is not necessarily the right way to go either. There's things that we do that are, that have judgment in them. And, you know, creating spaces for somebody to talk where we're present with them and for them, but we're not putting ourselves in it. We're not giving them, it's that empathy versus sympathy thing. And I think, you know, there's a million scenarios here and personal style will vary. You know, you know, being a man of my age means that I have a certain affect that's expected of me. and my, my demographics and all that play into it. And I think just very broadly, I just would reiterate, like, try getting away, see how you can get away with doing less of whatever it is that you're doing. And can you kind of continue to downsize that and feel very present, connected with that person and give them everything, but not be so demonstrative of it. And like, what does that feel like over time to kind of right size or downsize, I guess, the amount of feedback that you're giving?
Lots of gems and wisdom there, and you've made me paranoid as you've been talking about how much I'm nodding at you. It's absolutely, it's very, very true. And I guess it's what makes what we do so, for us, such a fascinating discipline. It's such a privilege to be able to do this, to kind of poke into people's lives and ask them, very probing questions in some cases about how they live, how they do certain things, how they, whatever it might be that we're investigating and researching. But you can always improve, and even having done this for years and years and years, one can always improve. But hence the need for books like yours. Few final questions, Steve, before we wrap up. What do you love about what you do?
Well, I'm going to answer that with the thing that you just said, we can always improve. And you mentioned the second edition. One of the fun things about the second edition was being able to write about mistakes that I had made. So, I you said something really great. Like, it's a privilege to like just go and learn about people, learn about the world and make these connections. And they feel very, impactful and real. I think that is a privilege. And I do love that. So I think what I love about being a researcher is you put it really well, as a researcher that teaches researching, let's just say, I get to make mistakes and learn from them. There's nothing like having like a chapter or a slide in a deck where you explain to people, don't talk about yourself, and then going out and doing it, and then seeing it fall flat, and then being mad, and then taking 3 days to realize, like, oh, that was me not following the advice I've been given out for years and years and years. I think I included that in the second edition where I basically, what I just said to you, I had advice, I failed to follow it. It didn't work out. I didn't understand. I blamed the other person. And so now I'm actually, hopefully a better researcher for making a mistake that I had taught people not to do. I mean, hopefully a better teacher, because now I have an example of like, why not to do that? Like, here's what, I have an example about, here's how it should work. The example of the meeting the Jewish participant is an old story of mine. But having an example where like, oh, I screwed this up, even though I should know because it's in the book. There's mistakes that have terrible consequences. There are mistakes that are just like, oh no, I should know better. So I love having those moments of, I feel like I'm learning as much as I am like writing about this and talking about this on podcasts and, have all my examples and so on. There's nothing like doing it. And I mean, succeeding at a little piece is great. Like, oh, I really pulled this thing off that was kind of challenging with establishing rapport, but also making mistakes and seeing very clearly what that tactic should be is, that's kind of fun. And that's obviously, I am privileged enough to make that sound fun because I'm not talking about job, performance review consequences or something like that. Like these are safe experiences that I'm having where I'm learning and kind of making note of it.
Well, and as you're talking, there's a quote, I can't remember who said it. It was a wise individual a long time ago, but something along the lines of, a teacher is someone who continues his or her education in public. And I think that's, in terms of kind of what you're talking about, I think there's a lot of, wisdom in that. In that, I think we should always be learning. Well, everyone should always be learning in their work, particularly in our discipline, in our world, because digital world is accelerating so fast. You can't sit on your haunches for long. And I sign up for so many newsletters that I just sadly never even get a chance to read because the inbox fills up and the day job takes over. But let me ask you the converse of that, Steve. What frustrates you about what you do?
Yeah. I mean, we talked a little bit about the level of access we have to in-person research, and that is, you know, that's something that I grieve. I guess that's different than frustration. What frustrates me? You know, it's like where to start, but what is something kind of, you know, useful to mention about that? You know, what we talked before about, you know, this being work done by agencies originally and sort of work done by in-house. And it certainly challenges me to, you know, to be someone who's a researcher. Cause like I do help teams. I do teach teams. I do, you know, work as kind of a consultant, but I also work as a researcher, and both those, I love teaching and researching. And I love that I can work for clients and kind of help them with their practice and help them, you know, with their research. Those are all great. I think, you know, what is it like for the sort of consultant researcher? You know, mostly teams want to invest in, and I realize right now that it's very uncertain, but the go-to solution is to hire someone. And I think that, you know, those of us that work as consultants, you know, our market is different. And that's an interesting challenge to be, you know, to still be in business and figuring out how do you work, what do you offer, who do you offer it to? And that it would be nice if that was always the same and never changed. And I would never have to, you know, not only learn the work of research, but also, you know, learn the work of operating a consulting research business. But it does change. And I guess the upside of that is like, oh, you get to do new things that you didn't know that you could do or anyone would want you to do. And with that comes some uncertainty. You know, and again, you want to talk about privilege, like I have a lot of privilege. And I guess, hey, everybody, like our careers are uncertain and our career paths are uncertain, you know, at points of privilege as well. I'm challenged by like what to do about that. There's always something different to be doing. And so while that is stimulating and not boring, it also is, you know, it's uncertain, right?
That leads on to my kind of one of my final questions. You know, I mentioned artificial intelligence at the beginning. We haven't touched on it much in this conversation, which is interesting in and of itself. But I mean, it is so much change has happened so fast. And a lot of the tooling that we touched on, kind of sales AI as one way of, you know, user researchers kind of augmenting their skills, upskilling the work that they do. I'm interested to know, how do you foresee the impact of that on research as a discipline?
You know, I mean, I don't know. And I know everybody wants to ask that question and everybody thinks that somebody should have an answer. And there are some people that are like, oh, I've tried all these things and here's my analysis. You know, when I see all this discussion of it, I remember something I learned that someone said at a CHI conference, the CHI part of the Association of Computing Machinery in the 90s. And they were talking about AI and general AI, you know, generalized artificial intelligence, and like two problems they were super interested in then were speech synthesis and speech recognition, and which is, I think, is important because I think the point, some, it was a quote, but I don't know who the origin was, but this is when I first heard it. As soon as we figure out how to do something, we don't consider it AI. And I mean, I think that's interesting, right? Because we have, you know, computer-generated transcription now, which was done by people. And, you know, in the best possible situation, it is still done by people, but a huge amount of it is done by AI. Yeah. And we don't talk about that as AI. Like AI is always this future scenario thing, but, you know, it shows up and then kind of it makes work different, you know, easier, better or not, you know, what have we gained and lost with, you know, with speech rec? It's still a technology that we make fun of for how badly it performs. And that's like, you know, that's like, that was a joke on The Simpsons like 25 years ago. Like these are old jokes that are still sort of the norm. So I think we come to accept this poor performance from technology. We don't consider it AI because it sort of does something that, you know, fits in. So the narrative seems to be a lot about, you know, when we call them robots, the robots are taking our jobs, as opposed to sort of functionality or capability that looks like transcription or that looks like automation. Like, there's stuff that gets automated. And so I feel like, you know, that there's just a lot of sort of weird definitions. And I think what we have now is a lot of products or quasi products where, what would you say, like, their reach exceeds their grasp, you know, so you can get somebody who's making something and you can try something with it. You know, a friend of mine wrote me the other day and said, I don't know why or how they got some survey data into some AI, but all they told me was like, if you're worried about this, Steve, don't. That was kind of their take on it. They were super unhappy with the outcome. I think the yay-sayers are like, but it's getting better. Like, you know, you could do something you couldn't do 6 weeks ago. And maybe that's true. And maybe we're going to see things like better summarizers. You know, one of my friends who's quite wise said to me, I'm going to quote him poorly, but he said, an LLM can't do synthesis. Because it's a backwards looking technology, right? It's looking at whatever already existed. But synthesis is about connecting things in new ways. So by definition, you can't do synthesis. And I don't know, that's somebody else's like brilliant observation or provocative observation. So I think there's, you know, a tooling improvement that, I mean, we certainly need. But is there, you know, wholesale job replacements? Are like researchers not going to be needed to do these, to conduct interviews or to do analysis? I don't know. I mean, you know, if I were to say that's not possible, someone's going to make something that does something. So far, all those things perform terribly and are sort of laughable and sort of make Silicon Valley look stupid and sort of money hungry as opposed to, you know, clever and solving problems. So I don't know. I'll say one last thing about this. And there was a great article in The Atlantic by Ian Bogost, who's, I'm probably getting the wrong syllables emphasis on his name, but he's like, you know, a famous game designer who writes about technology and all sorts of things. And he wrote about how he was using Midjourney and DALL-E, however that's pronounced, to generate these fantastical images. And he was, you know, he's like, we're working in a magazine. We're trying to come up with ideas for cover stories. So, you know, what if hamburgers could dream? And he wasn't doing it to replace the use of a human illustrator. He was using it to generate sort of visualizations of like extreme, bizarre, hilarious provocations as possibilities. And so they would make a cover of something. And then that was something that he was using to consider where he might go with things. And so what I'm excited there is like, oh, AI is a partner. AI is extending capabilities. It's not replacing capabilities. So thinking about, you know, doing some research and coming up with a bunch of really critical how might we questions. And having a session where you explore that and feeding that to, you know, a tool that does sort of divergent thinking of a form and takes ridiculous possibilities and manifests them in a fantastical but tangible way. Like, what a great prompt to the humans being creative to sort of have this partner that makes fantastical stuff real temporarily. And so that to me is so interesting. And I don't see anybody kind of, and I'm, you know, I don't know everything that's being done, but I don't see anybody working on kind of the creativity partner aspect. Again, mm-hmm. I might be missing it. There might be that, but so what kind of, what would a synthesis assistant look like as opposed to an LLM that takes it over from you and does it? Like, what does that creative partnership look like where you can do something that you can't do because an AI does something that you can't do, and together you get somewhere.
Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. I could talk for hours. Thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your wisdom.
and your years of experience. And, you know, best of luck with the book. And I think there's going to be, you're going to provide a discount code. Is that right? That I can put in the show notes?
That's right. And the discount code is if you get this book from Rosenfeld Media, then Understanding Users, one word, will get you 20% off. And it's, I'll just say it's good to get the book from Rosenfeld Media because they're a small business and you can support a small business that publishes books, and you support authors a lot better when you kind of than from maybe one of the larger larger ways to get a book. So Rosenfeld Media also, if you buy a print copy, you get a digital copy included, which the larger retailers don't do. So lots of reasons, including that discount.
Fantastic. I'll put that in the show notes. And final question, how can listeners, anyone listening to this, connect with you or kind of find out more about you, Steve?
Yeah, people are welcome to check out my website, which is my last name, portugal.com. I'll post this podcast, a link to it when it goes out, for example, and you can see some of what I'm writing about or the work that I do or, you know, events and talks and so on. And LinkedIn is probably the platform to find me. I also talk about research and business and user experience and just trying to make sense of the world over there. So people are welcome to follow me, connect with me. I'd look forward to that. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to chat with you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Understanding Users. If you enjoyed what you heard, do please like or comment wherever you're listening, and feel free to share this episode more widely. And feel free, of course, to drop me a line with any feedback via LinkedIn or my website, researchable.uk. Join me again next time when I'll be sharing some more insights from digital design professionals. Until then, stay safe and stay user-centered.